going.
Is it all alone?
I think it is.
Yeah, it's going.
Today is November 26, 2009. I'm Isaac Jeremy, and I'm doing an interview for the Yukon Charlie Ethnographic Overview Project with Mike McDougall. Here in Eagle, and we're at the residence of Mike and Sonia. And first of all, I just want to let you know that I thank you for giving this interview, and that if you don't want to, you don't have to answer any of the questions that I asked. And these were just questions that had been forwarded to me, and I would like to start by the historical overview, personal background. Where were you born and raised?
I was born in Fairfield, California, and I lived there till I was 4 years old, and then my parents moved to Washington State. And that's where I was raised until I was about 19 years old. And went to college for a few years, and then came to Alaska in 1993. I've been here ever since.
Where were your parents born and grew up?
My dad was born in Western Washington State on a homestead. He was born in 1938, and he was raised in Washington State, and spent some time down in California when he was a teenager after high school, and then he met my mom down there, and they were married and 1959, and then moved back up to Washington State. And prior to that, my mom was from the state of Oklahoma, and she lived in Oklahoma till she was about 14 years old, and that's when she moved out to California and later met my dad. So that's my parents' background.
Where were your grandparents born, grew up?
My grandpa on my mom's side was born in Arkansas, and on my mom's side, my grandma was born in Oklahoma. Then on my dad's side, my grandpa was born in Scotland, and my grandma was born. I forget where my grandma on my mom's side was, or my dad's side was born. So.
Where were your great-grandparents born and grew up?
My great-grandparents on my father's side were born in Scotland and raised there. And then on my, it gets a little bit more fuzzy, on my mom's side, where my great-grandparents were born somewhere in the south. Oklahoma, Texas, Arkansas, and that region.
Is that a cute cat? Is that a cute cat?
What can you tell about the origins of your family and people?
My family and people, I come from a pretty diverse background. Sonia and I sat down and we did the pie chart of all the different cultures that I come from, and it's quite a mixture of Scottish, English, Irish, German, there's some Cherokee Indian on my mom's side of the family, so it's quite a diverse mixture of cultures that form together in my family to get me to where I am now. So,
are there any old beliefs, cultures, or traditions practiced by you or your family that remains important? And if so, would you be willing to share them?
Like I said, my family is, we come from such a diverse group of people to where I've come now. My family is pretty spread out. So, as far as practicing traditional cultures, we typically have like the traditional like Christmas, Thanksgiving, holidays, those types of things. But a lot of like the specific ethnic traditions are kind of, at least for my family, have been kind of, I hate to say lost, but they've just been spread out. So what I find now is that I'm married and I'm living in Eagle with my wife Sonia, is I'm beginning to pick up more of the traditions and cultures of my family here and Sonia's family and those types of things. So it's kind of a roundabout way of answering that, but it's...
What crafts or other specialized things do you do?
I would say as far as crafts, I do a little bit of woodworking. I trap, so I classify pelt handling and fur handling as a craft. I do some fur sewing of like hats and mittens and things like that I need just for our own use. So yeah, your beaver hat that I showed you. So those are the things that we do. And as dog mushers, we're kind of crafting, you know, our dog gear and working with lines and ropes and things like that, sort of a matter of necessity. And I'm learning how to, with fishing, learning how to mend nets. That's kind of a craft in itself right there. So seems like the crafts that we work with mostly are kind of tied and linked to some of the subsistence activities that we do.
How would you describe your identity, such as your beliefs, your ancestors, your culture, your connection to the land and community, your language, or the combination of these?
Well, as I said before, I come from a pretty diverse background, but what I know from my ancestors and having reached this far, we've all had significant ties with the land. My father, my uncles down in Washington State were always, every year they went out hunting and gathering and firewood and those types of things. And so those sort of ethics and values have been passed on to me. And so Sonia and I both, we have our ties to the land are very strong in that a lot of the food and that we consume comes from the land. We're most happiest when we're out on the land, you know, doing our subsistence activities. via firewood or picking berries or things like that. So it's vitally important to us. So, but as far as going back to my ancestors, we've always had ties to the land.
What else do you identify with that defines yourself and your family?
I would say we identify ourselves as being kind of ties back to the land question, you know. It is, I see ourselves identifying with our local culture, our community, our sense of ties to the land and subsistence harvest and those sorts of things. So. And also just tying everything together with our family and the community. So I'm not sure if that answered your question or not.
That would be good. Part 1B will be the historical overview, community background. What do you know about Eagle's distant past?
What I know of Eagle's distant past. And when I hear the word distant, I think of, you know, I remember talking with a TCC archaeologist, and he told me that this area has been inhabited for at least 9,000 years by the descendants of the Han. So 9,000 years, that's quite a long time. And in that time, there's been, they've been able to, or they have evidence that there's been changes in the climate throughout that time. And there's evidence in Canada of people using, hunting caribou for many thousands of years in this region. And from what I understand of the Han culture, before contact with the white contact, they used to travel up what is now Eagle Creek up into the Ogilvy Mountains and then come down Sheep Creek down to the Yukon, and they followed a yearly cycle, and where they would go more inland during the winter, and then by the summer they would come back down to the river to fish and do subsistence activities and so on. And so that's my understanding of the distant past leading up to contact during just before the gold rush and the Hudson Bay Company coming in and trading. During that period of time. So that's my understanding of the distance. So.
How have mining activities in the area affected life in Eagle?
Well, that question leads us up to from the distant past to the contact and the gold rush in 1898. And that had an immediate effect on the community of people that were living here prior to the gold rush. And that it's my understanding that the local Han were displaced up river 3 miles from the former site. So there was a lot of a clash of cultures, so to speak. So as far as the physical impact on the land, you have the mining that occurred down at Coal Creek and some up on the 70 Mile. that affected the land in sort of minor ways as far as mining goes. But I think the big impact that happened from when mining was just the impact that it had on the cultures that were here, if you know what I mean. So that's what I see happening with the mining. So far we haven't had any huge open pit mines or anything that is going to really ravage the landscape. But we've had a lot of small-scale mining. But it's not sort of the active mining itself that was sort of the big impact. It's the impact on the culture.
Are there any old stories about floods that you might know?
Well, since my time actually in Eagle is fairly limited, since I've only been here for about 3 years after marrying my wife, the only stories that I hear, there's the 1992 flood, the one in the early 90s, and then I've seen pictures of some of the older floods that they've had, like in the 20s and 30s and things like that. But it's mostly just things that I hear, bits and pieces. And I know people that actually experienced the 90s flood in my life and heard stories from them. But that's about it.
What role has the church played in the development of Eagle?
I'm sorry, can you say that again?
What role has the church played in the development of Eagle?
Well, the church, as far as the development of the community, I think there's a strong religious component to this community. So as far as its bringing the community together, I think for a lot of people in this community, the church sort of provides a focal point for them in the community, and that's sort of my perspective of the church, is that it provides sort of a sense of community support for a lot of people.
What role has the school played in the development of Eagle?
I would say, you know, for the school, it's kind of like the church, in that it sort of provides a sort of a focal point for the community. For some kids, there's a lot of kids that are homeschooled in this community, in which case I think the church, for a lot of those kids, sort of provides that sort of focal point for them. But the school is definitely provided sort of a community platform for not only education but for a lot of community events and opportunities to learn and things like that. So most recently, I know like there's a 4-H group coming out of the school. We recently started a community garden at the school, so things like that is what the school provides.
How do you feel that life in Eagle has changed with the coming of new residents?
Well, I guess I would be one of those new residents. So that's kind of a hard question for me to answer, you know. So
has it gotten better?
I hope so. It's kind of like Sonia was saying, you know, we need more more younger people in this community, because along with the kids that are in the community now, you know, more, if we had some more younger, enthusiastic couples and people living here to kind of provide sort of a sustainable base for the community, I think it would be, that would benefit the community there. So, but I'm one of those newcomers.
How do you think that tourism has affected the community of Eagle?
I think tourism is overall, it's kind of benefited the community in that for some, in that it provides opportunity for some people to sell local crafts and things like that. With tourism, it's kind of a double-edged sword. Because on the other hand, you know, you have two busloads of people coming in every day all summer long. And so far, you know, it's been kind of a low-impact type of thing. But I agree with Sonia, you know, I wouldn't want to see there be any sort of large hotels or anything here. You know, right now you get a busload of tourists come in, they jump onto Yukon Queen and go up to Dawson, and then things kind of quiet down. But I don't see Eagle as benefiting from like a upscale hotel type of business. I don't think that would be a good thing for a community.
What draws new people to Eagle, and what causes them to decide to leave?
I think for a lot of people, sort of with my background, you know, you hear about Alaska, and there's sort of a romantic notion of going to the interior of Alaska and trying to make a living there and that type of thing. And then a lot of people actually come here and they may spend some time, but then they figure out that after they've been here a while that, you know, there's limited access to health care and employment and things like that. So it takes a certain amount of fortitude to live in a community like this, and that there's a sense of community and people are really helping one another out, but there's also, you have to be a little bit independent too at the same time, and be able to live without a lot of the things that people take for granted in other places, like being able to drive to the grocery store or having your pick of 50 dentists or something like that, you know, and that's what makes people leave, is that sort of thing. So I would say, that's pretty much it for that.
What is your opinion of the leadership of Eagle, and what ideas might you have?
From what I've observed of the leadership of Eagle, is that you have the city of Eagle, and you have its leadership, and then you have the village and its leadership. And as far as my observation of the leadership in the village, honestly, I can't say a lot about that. And because I haven't observed, or I don't know much about that. But what I do see is that there's a dichotomy between the two communities, and they don't interact. It's like there's a barrier that I don't fully understand, but I'm aware of it, and it exists, and is there. From the city of Eagle, from what I observed of that leadership, is that it's firmly entrenched. It's firmly entrenched and meaning that it's been there for a long time, and it seems like you know, you have a lot of the business owners and things like that representing the community. And as far as leadership direction, I think overall it's kind of like with having new people come into the community. I think maybe in the long term, and this is going to have to happen, is that we might need to see some of the people that have been on that city council for a long time step aside and let some new people come in that might have fresher ideas as to where to take this community, you know, and that type of thing. So, but what you don't see is a lot of people stepping up to the plate. So that kind of comes back to having, if we had some newer, younger people in this community that were willing to take a leadership role, then we might see some new type of direction in the community. So.
What other historical?
I'm sorry?
What other historical events do you feel are important to Eagle's past?
Well, starting with most recent history, I think this most recent flood, that has definitely had a significant mark on the community. But it's like, when I was listening to Sonia's interview, you can kind of see these different little epochs of history throughout Eagle. And can you not throw those right here? Sorry, I lost my train of thought. You have all these different little epochs of history for this community, and I think every one of them is important to the history of this community, and it goes way back, and you can't just stop at the gold rush and everything leading up to that. You got to keep going back. Because, like I said, from what I understand, is that there's been people here for 9,000 years. So you just can't forget about that other 8,900 years of history. So I'd have to agree with Sonia on that.
Part two, subsistence and employment in Eagle. What kind of work have you done in the past while living in Eagle?
Well, while I've been in Eagle, I've been employed by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game during the summer. I work from around July 1st through the first week in October, and then as a seasonal employee. Then the rest of the year, I'm mostly doing subsistence activities such as hunting, trapping, cutting firewood and things like that. So that has been my employment history in the community.
How would you describe employment opportunities in Eagle?
I would say that the employment opportunities exist in this community, but I would say that they're fairly limited. In that it's pretty much the same sorts of things that are in other parts of rural Alaska. Like you have your government sector, you have the store, you have the school, things like that. And there are some small businesses with a few mechanics, that type of thing. So overall, it's fairly standard for rural Alaska, but it's fairly limited.
What does subsistence mean to you, and do you practice in subsistence activities in the Eagle area?
What subsistence means to me is, it means many things. It means subsistence is it's a tie to the land. It's a tie to your community. Subsistence is the only way that Sonia and I could live in this community and continue to stay here, because it provides us with not only food, but heat for our home. And it provides a spiritual connectivity to the land. So it means all of those things to us. It's, it means many things.
When do you hunt, fish, trap, and collect?
Okay. You say when. It seems like we're all the time going for after something, whether it's firewood or berries or things like that.
There it goes.
Let's see, which question were we on? Oh, times to gather. Yeah, I was going to start in.
And what I mean by that is just at different times of the year you do these activities.
Yeah, we're usually all year long we're doing something, but starting in July we have the king harvest, and we fish for Chinook salmon during that time, and then after Chinook salmon is caribou season. And that's pretty short, but that's around August 10th. And after that leads us up to fishing for fall chum salmon for the dogs. And that's pretty labor intensive into September. Sonia and I like to fish late for our dogs into October so they can hang whole fish and freeze them. After that, if you haven't got a caribou during the early season, there's an opportunity usually to go out in November for the winter hunt. Oh, and I forgot about moose season. Moose season is vitally important in September. So from about the 1st of September to the end of September is moose season.
How have state and federal regulations helped you or hinder your use of your subsistence activity?
Well, I think overall it's kind of been a mixed bag for whether it's helping or hurting. I think the state and the federal agencies are doing the best they can with the tools they have to manage the fisheries, and in that this season the restrictions and the compromise that occurred on the river for Chinook salmon benefited everyone, in that we had opportunity to fish drainage wide, yet we still made escapement in the Canada better than we expected for Chinook salmon. But then you look at the flip side of the coin on that. I'll use the caribou as an example of a state-federal joint management regime where you have state seasons not completely aligned with federal seasons, and up on the summit you have state administered lands and federal administered lands, and then the caribou are running around on both of those. And usually when the caribou are on the state land, the season's not open, and that can be frustrating, especially during the winter hunt. And so I think it's kind of been a mixed outcomes as far as the state federal management for the different resources. And those are just a few examples that I've had experience with.
What ideas do you have for Eagle's economic stability?
I think that there's a good potential for sort of having a limited, sustainable, small-scale ecotourism ecotourism businesses in this community. Like if we had some canoe guiding and people teaching about natural history of the area on a small scale. I think it's one thing if you take and bus people in for half a day and then they leave, they don't really get a sense of what it is to be in this community or the surrounding area. But if you were to I think overall, if you were to have something like that, where you had some small-scale guiding opportunities for people who could have a low impact on the land, and at the same time have an opportunity to teach people about the culture and history of this area, that would be one idea that I would have. I think we could look into some sustainable energy development here, whether it be wind or solar or hydropower or something like that. I know they were exploring having a turbine in the river for power, things like that. But I think overall what it has to be is it's got to be something that's sustainable and something that will not have adverse impacts on the land. So something along those lines.
Do men and women do the same type of work in Eagle, or do they tend to do different types of labor? What about in the past?
I think in the past, from what I understand, the labor was more men and women that had different roles in the family. But now, like in our family, in a lot of different families around here, men and women take on sort of, it's more of an egalitarian type of situation where men will do the dishes and work on child care as much as the women will, and women are involved in the subsistence activities, so all the work is shared. But it's not necessarily a case for each family. It's kind of based on a family to family. Like my family splits the labor a lot different than some of the other families in this community. So it's kind of been a little bit, it's changed. So that's how I see it.
Part three is experience of flooding and climate changes. Were you here in 1975? Can you tell me about the land and the weather was like?
Well, I wasn't here in 1975, so I can't really talk to how things were here at that time, so.
Were you here in 2009? Can you tell me about what the land and river, what the land and weather was like?
Well, I was here in 2009, and as far as the weather in 2009, I know leading into 2009 we had some what I saw were some extreme swings in temperature in the winter in January. Leading into 2009, we had some pretty bitter cold temperatures. We saw 60, 65 below for a couple weeks at the very start of the year. And then right at the end of that cold snap, we saw it warmed up to 40 and it rained. And so you went from this deep freeze to this Chinook thaw came in, and for about 4 days it was well above freezing. And then it settled back into kind of a normal temperature range, you know, anywhere from 0 to 20 below, that type of thing. It was like that from what I remember the rest of the winter until we got in the spring. In April, we had some of the warmest temperatures on record, and it seemed like right at the end of April, it got really warm. All the snow melted, and then that led us into the that huge breakup that resulted in the flood here. So looking back over that whole pattern, it's like you're starting to see these extremes where you have like some bitter, bitter cold followed by a real warm spell, then sort of stabilizes, then you get another warm spell. And that's what ultimately led to the violent breakup, I think, on the rivers. What we also saw is even before, you know, in the fall of 2008, the river froze really high. So we had things going on. We had a lot of rain. There's a lot of rain in the upper Yukon watershed of Yukon. So going into fall, the river was higher than it normally is. So it froze higher. And then you follow that with the bitter temperatures in January. And the USGS did they drill test holes out here to see how thick the ice is leading into breakup, and it was something like 130% of normal. And so what we're starting to see is these extreme swings and temperature, and then the effects that has is like, well, the effect of that is we had more ice on the Yukon that was thicker. And then that was followed by a rapid melting at the end of April. So it was this sort of perfect storm of events that led to a catastrophic breakup that we saw this spring. So, and I think there's a lot of people that feel that that, as we're observing global climate change, that these sorts of events, they might not happen every year, but they're going to start to become more common. So that's my observations of directly in this community. And around here, I've also noticed that in 2005, we had a summer that was pretty dry. And I've noticed that there's many different areas along the river where a lot of the trees are stressed. You see a lot of spruce trees that are sick and dying, and whether that's due to a drought stress. And Sonia observes a lot of the willows in this area have been affected and are dying early. You'll see them get brown, and the leaves wither up early in the summer. So those are some of the observations that I'm starting to see in this area.
Were you here during the flood of 2009?
I was.
What happened?
I was here. And I remember that day. So I went down in front of the old store, right by the retaining wall. Yeah, I'll mention that. And Sonia and I were very lucky in that our house is about a mile from the river, so we didn't lose our home or any of our belongings, but many of our friends did. And I remember that day because I went down by the store and I could see what to me looked like the water coming up from the edge of the ice. The ice hadn't had time to really start to rot, and it was so thick. And usually what you see at a normal breakup is the ice gets really candly and then it has time to kind of slush out. Well, that didn't happen this year. What happened is the water started coming in from all the side creeks, and then it started bubbling up on the edge of the ice, and I could see what looked to me like water from the 40 Mile River. It's kind of the color of really strong iced tea. And it was bubbling up on the edge, and I thought, boy, I bet the river goes out today. And it was about 9 o'clock that night that my father-in-law called and said the river was starting to move. So we went down and we looked at it, and it was moving nice. It jammed in between the retaining wall and Bell Island. And then we went down to the boat landing, and the water was already starting to back up to the boat landing by about 10 o'clock. And then we drove out to the village, and the water was kind of starting to back up the culverts onto the road and flood the road quite a bit. And I remember we looked at it, and when I was at the boat landing, I remember looking out across the river, and between Bell Island and Bell Island and Lundeen Slough, I could see house-sized pieces of ice, huge pieces of ice. Never seen a breakup like that. Moving along at what to me looked like very fast, like 10, 12 miles an hour. And I remember thinking, man, if anything gets in the way of one of those pieces of ice, it's going to be done. So that made a big impression on me, is that this breakup was different than the one breakups that we had in the years before, where it's more like that real candly slush ice just kind of moving out. Well, this is different. It was big pieces of ice moving downriver. And so we watched it for a while, and then we came back up the hill, and then I guess it was a few hours later that it jammed up and came up over the bank. So.
What do the elders say about erosion, flooding, or storms?
Well, as far as this community, I really haven't talked with any of the elders about those different issues. But I have worked in different areas of the Yukon drainage on different projects with Yukon River Drainage Fisheries Association and things like that. And talking with some of those elders, you hear stories about how breakup comes earlier. Up on the Kayakuk River, there's changes in the water color, things like that. More thunderstorm activity, that's one thing that sticks out in my mind. Of course, on the coast and Shishmaref and areas like that, there's more violent winter storms that you hear about now, and things like that that I'm hearing. There's a lot of talk from the elders and the Kiakut country about different whitefish lakes starting to dry up. Places that they used to be able to fish for whitefish, or you can't fish there anymore because they're starting to dry up and become these grassy fields instead of these lakes. So there's things like that that are occurring.
Mama, do not.
How does the community react to the flood in the past? Evacuation, moving houses, protecting kids and elders.
Well, from the stories that I hear about the earlier flood, is people kind of pull together and do what they can to get the resources they have at hand to help move the elders and the children to safer ground, higher ground. But I think it all depends upon how much advance warning you have and the resources that you have available to you. So, if people are prepared ahead of time, then they can have a plan in place to move people quickly. But if you're caught unaware, then you're not going to have time, you know, necessarily to do things as efficiently as you could. So.
Do you notice changes in temperature, rainfall, snowfall, rain, rivers, lakes, or ponds in the Eagle area?
Well, in my time in Eagle, you know, I've been here a full-time resident for 3 years now. So as far as this specific area, I only have that background. But in my time in Alaska, most of my time has been spent in the interior. I've seen what seems to me to be sort of an overall warming trend. Seems like the winters aren't as warm as they, or they're not as cold as they used to be. Like the temperatures that we have right now, they seem pretty mild for the end of November. So it's things like that that I'm starting to notice.
Please describe what the river and the region means to you in personal and practical time.
Well, personally, you know, my wife grew up here, and she has a lot of ties to the river. And the river is important to myself and our family. It seems like some of the most happy times I have, or when I'm enjoying life the most, is when I'm on the river, you know, doing our different subsistence activities and that type of thing. And it's important to Sonia and I that we start getting our kids out on the river.
And you're out on it every morning.
Yeah. So the river is very important to us. You know, it provides us with our food. It's our link to our different subsistence resources, be it firewood or moose, fish, that sort of thing. So if the river wasn't here, I don't think it's the river that's defining what this community is. So.
Part 4, the Yukon Charlie Rivers National Preserve. What is your overall opinion of the Yukon Valley Rivers National Preserve?
Well, my overall opinion of the preserve is I'm glad the preserve exists. I think the preserve does a good job of, it's exactly what it is. It's preserving those lands and making them available for subsistence and providing an opportunity for people to be able to do the subsistence activities, their ties to their culture and their community, and as a means of sustaining themselves and their way of life. So I think the preserve is a good thing in that it's protecting those lands from those who may have designs on engaging activities that may harm the land overall, you know, whether it's mineral, oil, gas exploration, that type of thing is what we don't want to see occur in the preserve at all. So that's what I see is the role of the preserve is protecting and maintaining those lands and making them available for people to engage in subsistence.
Yeah. What has been the most positive thing of the preserve since the establishment?
The most positive thing? I would have to say that it kind of just links to the question that's answered is that it's providing opportunity for people to be able to do their subsistence activities. And I think that overall that's the most positive thing. I know from a Park Service perspective, they provide an opportunity for visitors to come and experience the Yukon Trail Preserve and that type of thing. But as far as the people that live here, I think the most beneficial thing is our being able to have access to those lands and their subsistence activities.
What has been the most negative thing of the preserve establishment?
Well, I think you hear a lot of stories about when the preserve is established and how they first administered the land and how they sort of made it restricted. And when they first came in and started administering the preserve, they were kicking a lot of people out of the preserve, and they were trying to enforce rules on this land that may have been appropriate for lands in the lower 48, and that model didn't necessarily work for people who were living and existing here prior to the preserve being here. So I think the most negative thing is how the Park Service was dealing with that, and you still see the animosity towards the preserve by some of those people, you know, and those sorts of feelings they transcend generations. It's handed down. So once that damage is done, it's hard to undo it. So that's the most negative thing that came out of the preserve, is some of the actions that they took in dealing with the people who were living there.
I think question number four. What do you know of the people who live in the preserve and since its establishment? And what was the opinion of the park? If you know and are willing to share this with us, but I think you mentioned that right up there. Do you make use of the preserve for hunting?
fishing, trapping, or any other activity?
Yeah. We use the preserve for hunting, fishing, and trapping. And I think I'd just like to say here that the preserve is going to become even more important for us for engaging in those activities as our kids start to grow up and start engaging more and more in those activities. Those preserve lands are going to be vitally important to the fishing, hunting, trapping, firewood, all just being engaging in different activities and having that spiritual connection of being on the land. That is important to us, and that's something that the preserve can provide and should provide.
What advice do you have concerning the preserve and its management?
I believe that the preserve should be managed to provide subsistence opportunity for the local residents. I think that should be their number one mission. Well, managing subsistence that goes hand in hand with protecting the land. So, and preserving those lands. Because protecting the land and subsistence go hand in hand. Because if you're not protecting the land, you're not going to have opportunity for subsistence resources. So, it's just those two things that the preserve should be looking for both. It's managing, protecting the land, and then managing for subsistence. And then after that, you can provide for a bigger opportunity to